his new book, The Twilight of the Elites. In it, Hayes offers a dark assessment of the last 10 years, what he calls the lost decade, where almost every type of authority failed the American public. A flawed security system that led to 9/11, Wall Street tycoons who caused the financial crisis, government officials who bailed out the banks while the little guys suffered, the Catholic Church, which allowed pedophile priests to harm children, and the media, which Hayes says repeatedly dropped the ball on major stories from the Iraq War buildup to the Wall Street meltdown. But the book is more than just a lament on what happened. Hayes examines why, and his answer upends a fundamental American ideal, the meritocracy, our widely shared belief that anyone who works hard and plays by the rules can get ahead. Today in The Exchange, what caused this twilight of the elites, the impact on the rest of us, and Hayes' prescription for a new beginning. Let's hear from you. Do you share this distrust in our major institutions or not? Are there some that have been more worthy of distrust than others? What role have political parties played in this, Democrats and Republicans? Give us a call, The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. And Chris Hayes joins us from New York City. And Chris, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's a real pleasure.
Well, you've got all sorts of examples of just how widespread this distrust is and how deep it goes. But just pull one out, Chris. Congressional approval ratings, you say, are so low that even Paris Hilton rates higher. How did Congress get such a terrible reputation?
Yeah, Congress is now essentially, and depends on the poll and when it's taken, but more or less reliably the least trusted institution in the country. Other things such as the U.S. going communist also outranks congressional approval.
Or
larger. Larry Lessig, who's a professor of law at Harvard and writes about corruption, has a great line where he says, which I quote in the book, where he says, it's almost certainly the case that the British crown was more trusted by the colonists before the revolution than our current Congress is today. And that's a pretty remarkable thing to consider when you realize that the Constitution begins with Article 1, which is the legislative body. This was the foundation of the representative government that the founders created. At the same time, that's the least trusted institution, and the presidency is also poorly trusted in a variety of institutions you've named. The most trusted institution by far in all the survey data, in fact, the only institution that's really seen trust in it increase over the last 10 years is the military. So you have a situation in which the most trusted institution in the country are the armed forces, the least trusted institution is Congress, and I think that would strike our, if we could go back in time, that would strike our founders as somewhat disquieting.
Well, you do say, after you give that statistic about the military being the most trusted American institution, you say that sound you hear is the founding fathers rolling over in their graves. How come?
Well, the founders, I mean, I think the military has achieved a lot of trust because it's shown a tremendous degree of competence in doing what we ask it to do as a republic. I mean, that's one of the things that's been remarkable is we've asked a tremendous amount of the military, the longest period of war in American history. And what we see is when we say, do this or, bring a strike brigade to this portion of a very remote province, they're able to do it. And so there's a basic level of competence that I think inspires a lot of trust in the American public. But let's remember, the founders didn't even want a standing army. they envisioned a system of militias which would be called up when necessary and then dissolved. They were very skeptical of standing armies. They thought standing armies were a step towards tyranny. What they really wanted the full authority and trust of the American Republic to be lodged in were the three branches of government and chiefly Congress, which they begin as Article I. So I think it would be difficult for them to envision the current situation that we're in.
Well, and getting back to Congress then, I mean, is the public being fair here, Chris? Because, we talk to our local members of Congress and sometimes they say, the media exaggerates all the bad news and all the dysfunction because it makes good headlines. But below the radar, we're working. We're working on it. The nation's business is largely getting done. So are we really being fair here?
I think we are. I mean, look, there is a core truth to the complaint that you mentioned, which I heard, and I was a political reporter in Washington, and I did a ton of reporting for the book, and I quote members of the legislature, making that point that we live in this insane news cycle that is obsessed with bad news, and Anthony Weiner's wayward Twitter picture ends up being a news story for 4 days, which in another era probably would not have, right? So there's a certain degree of truth to that. But I think if you take a step back and focus on the objective conditions of the country, the reason that we have distrust in our pillar institutions is because they perform very poorly. I mean, median wages have fallen in real terms by 7% over the last 10 years or so. We've had tremendous amount of stagnation. At the same time, we've had rising inequality. We have the worst financial crisis that we've had in 70 years, the longest levels of long-term unemployment since the Great Depression. We've been in the longest period of war since the founding of the Republic. We lost almost, we lost around 5,000 American lives in Iraq and 100,000 Iraqis, $800 billion in that war. We watched an American city drown helpless in front of all of our eyes. I mean, and I'm just hitting some of the biggest lowlights that we all remember. So, Congress is, I think people hold Congress accountable, particularly because they, it's more diffuse. The president, people have very polarized partisan feelings about. But Congress is at the core of American political dysfunction. I mean, what we've seen in terms of the abuse of the filibuster, what we've seen in terms of the debt ceiling debacle last year, these are fairly unprecedented. These are historically unprecedented levels of disruption, obstruction, and dysfunction that we're seeing. And so I don't think it's illegitimate or unfounded for folks to feel really frustrated with that body.
Well, and in fairness, over this lost decade that you talk about, the corporate sector doesn't come out smelling like a rose either. We had Enron and the Wall Street meltdown and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny to go back in the book and do a lot of research on Enron. And I spent some time in Houston. I talked to Sharon Watkins, who is the famed whistleblower who wrote the memo to Ken Lay saying, I fear that Enron will implode in a wave of accounting scandals, quite presciently. And, Enron has been lost a little bit, I think, in our memories, because what happened right after it was the Iraq War, and then years later, the financial crisis. And so Enron, we don't think about that much. But at the time, it was the largest corporate bankruptcy in history. It took out one of the big five pillar accounting firms. And there was also a law passed, Sarbanes-Oxley, where we all said, well, we can't have this again, right? We can't have this kind of corporate.
Yeah, we keep saying that, don't we?
But yeah, exactly. We can't have this kind of corporate malfeasance. And of course, when you look at Lehman Brothers, whose failure precipitated the real depth of financial crisis that we lived through in 2008 and 2009, a lot of the things Lehman Brothers were doing in terms of hiding things off balance sheet look startlingly familiar to what Enron was doing. So it doesn't seem like we really learned the lessons of that.
Well, and it's interesting, and you talk to other whistleblowers besides the woman who foresaw that Enron would collapse, people who had concerns that we might have a 9/11, who saw that a Katrina could happen, who predicted the housing bubble would burst. What's the general theme that you get from these whistleblowers, Chris, again, given your work on this book, about why nobody listened to them?
It's a really good, deep, profound question that I'm not sure I have the complete answer to. But I do think one of the things that happens is that there's a certain kind of elite groupthink that happens. And it happened with the housing bubble. Let's take the housing bubble just to concretize this for a second, right? I talk about in the book, the housing bubble was happening, and there were lots of people in positions of tremendous power, including Alan Greenspan, including Ben Bernanke, who was not yet the chair of the Federal Reserve, but he was on the board, saying, don't worry, this isn't a bubble. And there, you can go through a catalog of financial journalists saying that and economists saying that, people in government saying that. There were other people dissenting. And one of the ways I think we can think about why there was that disconnect is this the idea of social distance. I went down to North Carolina where I was with a group called the Center for Responsible Lending, and they work on predatory lending. And what they were seeing in neighborhoods, working class neighborhoods in Raleigh-Durham, for instance, were, African-American grandmothers who had taken out a second mortgage that was incredibly predatory in its terms. The equity had been stripped out, and they were now facing the loss of their home. And this was happening in the communities that they were representing. They were on the ground, and these folks were coming into their office and saying, look, these horrible things are happening. This was in 2002, 2003. They started raising alarm bells. They even had people and some of their allies who work on these issues in meetings with the Federal Reserve saying there is a tremendous amount of dysfunction that is working its way through the system in terms of what loans are being given out and how they're working. And the problem was that the people at the top of the Federal Reserve were just entirely removed from that reality. So even being presented with some spreadsheets and some charts and a PowerPoint in a meeting that you have with an activist and, midway through an afternoon of a very crowded day, it doesn't have the visceral connection to decision makers that talking to a grandmother who's about to lose her home does. And one of the dangers of a society that becomes more stratified, that becomes less equal, is the social distance of those making decisions from the people those decisions affect. And I think in terms of the housing bubble, that was why the leaders of the country weren't able to put their finger on it. They were increasingly removed from what was happening in certain sectors of the subprime market, which then spread to the rest of the economy.
So social distance of the people making the decisions from the people who are affected the decisions, that's part of the problem. The elites are not talking to, meeting, knowing real people.
Yeah, I mean, there's a very self-contained nature. And I want to be clear here. I understand, like, I'm a cable news host right now. It drives me crazy when I see people sort of throw around the term elite and not acknowledge where they are in this.
Be elite themselves.
Right, yeah, I don't want to have some, I mean, I grew up working class family in the Bronx, and those are my roots. But, you know, I'm sitting right now in 30 Rockefeller Center, and I have a cable TV show, and I love doing it, and I feel extremely lucky and privileged to do it. So I don't want to – I feel myself implicated in this. In fact, part of the reason I write the second chapter of the book about my own high school is
right.
Because much of what this book is wrestling with the failure of people that are in my social cohort, right? People that I think are
– your fellow elitists, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, fellow elites are people that are products of this system of meritocracy. So, yeah, I think that what ends up happening is – the world, as inequality increases, as the meritocracy produces a group of people that are increasingly have dense networks with each other, are increasingly removed from the reality.
All right. And Chris, I got to cut you off there.
Sure.
But coming up after a break, we'll dig into this idea of the meritocracy and why you say it is to blame. We'll also take your calls, so keep it right here.
You're listening to The Exchange here on NHPR. And coming up at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, millions of Americans take statins to lower their cholesterol. But new research questions the benefits for patients without heart disease and suggests these drugs can trigger dangerous side effects. That's coming up at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show here on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, from SchoolSpring, an online employment source connecting 21st century educators with New Hampshire schools. Information at schoolspring.com. And from Champlain College's Master's Program in Early Childhood Education, hosting an online information session on Tuesday, June 19th at masters.champlain.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Chris Hayes is with us, editor-at-large of The Nation and host of Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. His new book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, explores what he calls the crisis of authority in American life. The book's brand new, just out today. This is Chris Hayes' first book interview. Join us with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Do you share some of this widespread distrust that he talks about of all our major institutions, or not? Do you think some of the institutions we've been talking about are more worthy of distrust than others? And what do you think's behind this crisis of confidence Hayes writes about? What role do the political parties play in this, Democrats and Republicans? Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook, so we hope you go to our page. Join the conversation there. And Chris, before we go to our listeners, let's dig into this now. The meritocracy, and this is going to take some untangling because This is really a cherished American ideal. I certainly share it with my kids, you know, that, you know, you work hard, you play by the rules, and you're going to be all right. So first of all, what is the meritocracy?
So the American dream, right, of social mobility, let's say, of working hard, starting out at whatever station in life and ending up with success due to your own drive, ambition, pluck, ingenuity, talent, brains, so forth, right? That's a very old vision. In fact, de Tocqueville, when he comes to the U.S., you know, writes about the fact that he says the word peasant is unknown in these quarters, right? Because they don't have the legacy of feudalism here. Of course, he's talking specifically about white folks who are not enslaved, right? But among white Americans, right, freed Americans, there was a relative classlessness to the new enterprise known as the United States because it did not have the feudal inheritance of Europe, And it, from the very beginning, there was a vision of social mobility that was part of the American ethos. The meritocracy is a specific, updated vision of that American dream with a set of institutions that produce it that comes out of the social upheaval of the 1960s, in which basically we say, look, you know, reacting to a white, WASP, male, patriarchal establishment that brought the Vietnam War, most specifically, and also oversaw segregation, there is a series of social movements, feminism, the civil rights movement, and later gay rights movement, that say, you know, it's crazy to have a country ruled by this small demographic cohort. We need to open it up. And the vision of the meritocracy is a vision in which people of all colors, creeds, genders, sexual orientations, no matter where they're from, they work hard, and if they're bright and industrious, they will end up being funneled into the positions of leadership at the heights of our command, the commanding heights of our economy and government, right? The folks who graduate from Harvard Law, for instance, and go on to be, in this case, President of the United States, right? Barack Obama is the crowning achievement of the post-60s meritocratic vision, right? There's no other period in time when we could imagine a man named Barack Obama with the skin color he has, the family he has, the background he has, rising to become the leader of the country. Right?
So it sounds all good, Chris. I mean, what's wrong with this?
Yes, yes. And all of this as a vision sounds good. You know, the problem is that it's based on a premise that we can neatly separate equality of opportunity from equality of outcomes, right? We in the U.S., we're not real big on equalizing outcomes. We leave that to other countries, social democracies, and in extreme cases, right, Marxist regimes. We want a level playing field, equality of opportunity. The problem is those two are just not so neatly separated. And what we have seen is that huge disparities in inequality of outcomes makes living up to the promise of equality of opportunity, of a level playing field, impossible. Because people at the top are able to rig the game in their favor. They're able to confer outsized advantages to their children. And so the system becomes distorted, even as we cling to the vision that somehow we're going to keep equalizing. We're going to make poor inner city schools better, right? we're going to make sure that everybody has an equal shot. And that just hasn't borne out in what we've actually seen in American society. What we've seen is accelerating inequality, which is the highest it's been since the Gilded Age, and declining social mobility under this period of time. Declining social mobility, which means the odds of ascending to the top from the bottom get longer and longer as we go through the same period in which we've created a system in which that is the absolute goal, right? That's what we all want. We all want that dream to be realized. And the actual data on this shows that it's a vanishing dream. So there's something, I think, wrong with the model. The model is not working. It's breaking down in key crucial ways. I can talk about, I don't want to get too far into it, but I write about my own high school as a way that you can view this in a very concrete way.
Right, a high school that was a public high school, but it was for the quote-unquote best and brightest, and gives you really that microcosm of equality of opportunity as the principle, but we don't always stick with that principle. I want to invite our listeners to join us, Chris, and then I have a lot more to ask you about on this idea of the meritocracy. Our number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Also, we're on Facebook. Go to our page, join the conversation there. The number again, 1-800-892-6477. And Chris, let's take Gary first, calling in from Randolph. Hi, Gary. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Laura, for having me.
Sure.
Yeah, I think I view this with Ronald Reagan, where he made the statement that government isn't the solution, that it's the problem, and it's led to a whole host of deregulation, i.e. Glass-Steagall, et cetera, et cetera. That's one comment that I'd like to make. And then the other thing is I have a question for Chris, in that if what he's saying is true, how does he feel that Mitt Romney will rule if would act if he became president of the United States? He's grown up with a silver spoon in his mouth. He's only hung around with the elite of American society. He cannot relate to working class Americans at all. He doesn't know what it's like to have to juggle kids, a mortgage, worrying about health insurance or any of that stuff.
Okay, Gary, thanks for the question. And let's go back to Ronald Reagan. Government isn't the solution, it's the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's important to note that there's political and partisan valences to certain kinds of distrust, which is to say people on the left are more likely to distrust big banks in corporate America, more likely to trust unions in the government, and that's reversed for people on the right. Distrust in government is a product, I think, of two main things. One is a very concerted effort by a certain portion of the American political spectrum to wage a sustained assault on the trustworthiness of government, to highlight examples of it failing. And Ronald Reagan was probably the most gifted rhetorician in doing that. But also, I think particularly liberals like myself have to be honest that there's been a lot of government failure.
Katrina.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and one of the perverse consequences of Katrina was that a lot of people who were disposed to defund the government or have it reduce its sphere pointed to Katrina as exactly justification for that view, right? There's sort of self-fulfilling prophecy that, oh, look, government really can't do things well. I think it's important to resist that defeatist nihilistic urge, because I think that one of the things we see, and one of the amazing things about, you know, we talk about bureaucracy as a broad topic. We talk about government. But what's remarkable, if you cover bureaucracies, if you cover government, is the unbelievable range of functionality, right, in different bureaucracies. I mean, think about this. Remember when we went 10 years ago, 15 years ago? I remember we had plane crashes in this country all the time. It happened a lot. In fact, it was in the news all the time. Remember the value jet crash and whatever?
Yes.
Well, we have not had major commercial plane crashes. I mean, we basically had one right after 9/11 that was unrelated to 9/11. And we've gone years and years. And that's, you know, that's a product of the National Transportation Safety Board and a whole bunch of bureaucracies that are functioning pretty well, right? We also don't allow our nuclear weapons to fall into the wrong hands. We have a pretty good bureaucracy around that. So there are bureaucracies that function well and bureaucracies that function poorly. And one of the things that gets lost in the rhetoric about government being the problem is that there is figuring out how do you make bureaucracies function well and not just sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Well, and he mentioned Mitt Romney, and let me just turn the question a little bit differently if I could. I mean, certainly Mitt Romney did have a privileged upbringing, but you say in the book, Chris, that even people who had hard scrabble beginnings made it up through the system and are now in the elite, even though you'd think they could relate to those roots of, you know, the single mother struggling or the, you know, dad working three jobs, once people get to the elite, yeah, left or right, they kind of forget where they came from. They get this elitist groupthink that you talk about.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, I think the caller is right to note that, you know, if we're talking about this concept of social distance, Mitt Romney is someone who has had a remarkably privileged life and upbringing and has spent the entirety of his life from the moment that he was born quite removed from the experiences of the vast majority of Americans in terms of where they're coming from socioeconomically. But yes, I mean, look at some of the, you know, some of the great the towering figures of institutional failure during the failed decade. Angelo Mozilo, for instance, ran Countrywide. Countrywide was, you know, at one point the biggest mortgage lender in the country. It was also the biggest purveyor of subprime loans, and it ended up imploding. It was acquired by Bank of America, and Bank of America is still trying to unload some of the toxicity that it brought onto its balance sheet. You know, Angelo Mozilo was from the Bronx, which is where I'm from. He was the first in his close family to go to college, son of a butcher. He was very proud of those roots. He came from that world. Coming from that world, though, one of the things the meritocracy does is it transforms people's allegiance. It transforms their life, their worldview so much, because you're surrounded by peers who are all being told they're the best and brightest. You really come to believe that, and you come to associate with those people more than necessarily from where you came.
That's the thing that surprised me the most, is that it wasn't so much your background. No matter who you were or where you came from, once you got to the elite, your mind kind of closed off.
Yeah, and I think, look, I mean, I want to be clear that, you know, this is part and parcel of being human in any environment, right? I mean, if you're in high school and you're in the drama club, you want to impress your drama club peers, right? If you are on a hockey team, you want to do well for your you know, the folks on your hockey team. If you're in a band, you want to impress the other musicians. So we tend to associate ourselves, our status, our self-conception with our peers. What's pernicious, I think, about the meritocracy, and I quote a remarkable speech by the great writer, theologian C.S. Lewis, called The Inner Ring. And he makes this point. He says, have you ever had that feeling in your life? You walk into a room and two people are discussing something and they hush up when you walk in. And at that moment, you realize there's an inner ring that you are not privy to. And Lewis argues, he says, that moment, that desire to be on the inside of that inner ring is the seedbed of corruption, right? He said, you will find in your life that you will do things of which you are not proud to be in the inner ring. And I think one of the things that's dangerous about the way the meritocracy is set up and the way it structures the psychology and thinking of the people that it produces is that it is an endless series of inner rings. There is no top. it is a constant struggle for more status, money, power, success. And that provides endless opportunities to be corrupted in the way that C.S. Lewis identifies.
Well, Gary, thanks for the call. And again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. 1-800-892-6477. Liz is up next from Londonderry. Hi, Liz. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you, Laura. Hi, Chris. I was wondering, speaking of corruption, how the justice system fits in with all of this. I know the Supreme Court has taken a real dive in approval ratings. We have the highest rate of imprisonment of people, and it's the correction system is now tied to the profit margin and Wall Street, which New Hampshire seems to be entertaining that idea. Could you did you find any connections there?
You know, that's interesting, Liz, and I saw a headline about that just the other day, too, I think, about public trust, even in the court system declining. Thanks, Liz, for the call. Go ahead, Chris.
So the court has seen after Bush v. Gore, the trust in the Supreme Court, particularly, declined quite a bit, and then it recovered. Although it's still it's still not the highest it's been. I think the Affordable Care Act is going to greatly affect the decision on the Affordable Care Act will greatly affect trust going forward. In terms of the justice system as a whole, I think one of the things I mentioned, one of the peculiar attributes of American society at this moment, is that we have a society that is incredibly punitive on the bottom, right? I mean, we put more people in prison than essentially any other country per capita. We have a massive criminal justice funnel that costs a lot of money and engages in tremendous amounts of labor hours of just to process through all the people. And at the top, we seem unimaginably forgiving. you know, we haven't had real criminal sanctions for anyone at the top of the financial institutions that produced the crisis. A lot of them, some of them lost their jobs. They left with golden parachutes, and they're doing quite well, millions and millions of dollars in deferred compensation, even after tanking the global economy. And so this double standard, a society can be, you can have a society that's punitive and holds people to account up and down the social hierarchy, or you can have a society that, you know, whose chief goal and ethos is to be charitable and forgiving up and down the social hierarchy. But you can't have one that is relentlessly punitive at the bottom and unimaginably forgiving at the top. And increasingly, that's the way our society looks. And the legal system, the criminal justice system in particular, play a large role in creating that reality and giving off that perception.
Well, Liz, thanks for the call. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Our guest today is Chris Hayes. His new book is called Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. He explores what he calls the crisis of authority in American life. As I said, the book is brand new out today. This is Chris Hayes' first interview on it. We are looking at some of the themes that come up in this book, and we want to hear from you. Do you share this broad distrust that many Americans have of our major institutions? Are there some institutions that you think are more worthy of distrust than others? What do you think is behind this crisis of confidence Hayes talks about? And what role do the political parties, our political process, play in this? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Chris, here's an email from Joan in Contoocook, following up on the point Liz raised. She says, most people are willing to sacrifice and look ahead if they perceived a shared misery. Prosecution of those who have created the mess would go a long way toward feelings things can change. Perhaps behind the scenes, people are being prosecuted, but not so no one could tell. Joan asks, why is this not happening? Is this just a question of power? Now, forgive my memory if it's wrong, but I think during the Enron scandal, Ken Lay went to jail. I think he had a heart attack and died in jail.
Yep.
And didn't Jeff Skilling go to jail, too?
Still in jail. Yeah, Jeff Skilling did. And in fact, if you look at the amount of resources brought to bear on the Enron prosecution, they were notable and sizable, particularly compared to the there's a new financial fraud task force that has been appointed by the president. One of the members of that task force is Eric Schneiderman, Attorney General of New York State, who's made a lot of noises about being, you know, really rigorously investigating criminal wrongdoing, civil wrongdoing, and fraud in the lead up to the crisis. I mean, fraud was endemic in the system, and almost anyone who's done any reporting on it or looked through it can see that. And yet, we have not had accountability at the top. I mean, we just haven't. And I think she makes a really important point, which is part of people's frustration, part of people's sensation that the game has been rigged. That's a sensation I think that's shared on the left and the right in different ways. Part of that is due to the lack of accountability at the top. And I think it is power. I think one of the things we've seen is that people at the top, people with a lot of power, whether in government or in the private sector, have been able to insulate themselves from the normal mechanisms of accountability. And, you know, getting back to this idea of meritocracy, you can't have a meritocracy if once you ascend to a certain level, you no longer have to deal with the consequences of your actions, right? You can't have a system in which there's not accountability at the top. And I think the most glaring place where we've seen a lack of accountability at the top is in real sanction. And not just even sanction, criminal sanction, but just even moral, cultural sanction for the people who screwed up the economy to begin with. I mean, Jamie Dimon, you know, is still running JP Morgan Chase, and despite massive losses that took on their balance sheet during the financial crisis, and they just had a $3 billion bet that went wrong. And he had to go eat a little crow on the Sunday shows. But that's about it. You know, we need to see some genuine accountability if we're going to restore people's faith that the system is not totally rigged.
Well, Joan, thanks for that email. And again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You know, Chris, we're coming up to a break, but I did want to pick a little bit more at you with this idea of the meritocracy.
Sure.
What you said, equality of opportunity does not equal equality of outcomes. So after a short break, we'll talk about that a little bit more, because there are many people who feel like, look, if I work hard and you don't, I deserve to get ahead. And Chris Hayes, you don't. You spent all your time, you know, on your duff watching television. So we will talk about that after a short break. You can call in, too, at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. The email is exchange at nhpr.org. Also, you can go to our Facebook page and join the conversation there. We'll be right back.
Online at wordofmouthradio.org, U.S. military intelligence takes aim at the video games terrorists play.
They're not really particularly interested in the content of the games. What they're interested in is using it as a communication tool that the military might not be aware of.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth joins the massive multiplayer platform of new ideas. Online at wordofmouthradio.org.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, from Franklin Pierce University, presenting information sessions June 19th at their Manchester and Lebanon centers. Program details and directions at franklinpierce.edu. And from H.E. Bergeron Engineers, providing innovative engineering solutions to clients throughout New Hampshire, including Phase 1 of the Laconia WOW Trail multi-use pathway. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the ups and downs of American savings habits, how and why we spend and save, and what it means for the larger economy. Email us your questions and comments before the program at exchange@nhpr.org. And be sure to join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, The Twilight of the Elites. That's a new book by Christopher Hayes. We're looking at some of the concepts in this book, what Christopher calls the lost decade, and how he blames the American meritocracy for those failures. Join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or go to our Facebook page. And Chris, before we go back to our listeners, okay, this idea that you have in the book, equality of opportunity, everybody agrees with that, right, left. We should all have the same chance at the start. Equality of outcome, we don't agree with that. We feel like, look, if Chris Hayes sits on his duff and drinks beer and watches TV, and Laura Kanoy is up at, you know, 5 o'clock every morning working real hard, Chris Hayes doesn't deserve,
right?
Chris Hayes doesn't deserve equality of outcome. Sure. You don't deserve it, Chris. I worked 10 times harder than you did.
Yeah, no, I think that principle, in when phrased in those terms, right? I mean, even say in the book, there's a degree, you know, we wouldn't, for instance, want to give out surgeon's licenses by lottery, right? I mean, there's a certain core
knowledge or expertise.
Knowledge. There's a core truth to the idea, right, that, yes, people have different levels of drive and smarts and ambition and competence, and any institution that completely ignored that would be in trouble. And I think that's true, but it's even a truism. But to be more specific about what the critique is, let me just talk about my high school for a second, because I think it kind of captures it, right? I went to this high school, it was Hunter College High School in New York City, a really amazing place. Kids from all five boroughs take one test to get in, okay? It's unlike you know, the college system where there's all sorts of subjective metrics. Do you play basketball? There's affirmative action. There's legacies. There's recommendations and interviews. Nothing of that. The kids come in, you take a test in sixth grade. If you get in, you get in. If you don't, you don't. And it doesn't matter who your mom and dad are. You know, if Mayor Bloomberg's daughter took the test and she didn't get in, she wouldn't get in. And I don't think you could confidently say that of a lot of institutions, right? I mean, Harvard, things like that. I think we all have a sense that somehow, right, Mayor Bloomberg's, you know, kid is going to get into those. So in that way, Hunter really represents what we really like about this vision of meritocracy, right? Real, austere equality of opportunity. The problem is that over time, a school that was already underrepresented black and Latino youth in a city that's very black and Latino, the numbers of black and Latino students have declined fairly dramatically just in the last few years. And part of that is a product of the inequality in the city as a whole, right? So when we talk about equality of opportunity because everyone's taking the same test, of course people have vastly different elementary school educations, right? The elementary school education you receive on the Upper East Side and in East Harlem are quite different, right?
Sure.
We all know that. And also, we've seen the emergence of a very robust test prep industry around the Hunter test. You can go to a cram, what's called a cram school, and pay $1,000 or more for a week of sustained study of the test over winter break, right before you take it. There are tutors in Manhattan that charge $90 an hour to give kids test prep. And people I talk to around the school now say a lot of kids, if not most kids, have gone through some test prep to get in, which was not the case when I was there. So this is a perfect example, right, where we've set up a system where we say, okay, equality of opportunity, real austere vision where everyone takes the same test, and that simple pronouncement of equality of opportunity is just insufficient, right, to deal with all the ways that inequality outside of the realm of just taking the test are going to begin to distort the system. And that, to me, is sort of an allegory for the society as a whole, right? Even if we say we're going to have this equality of opportunity, that equality of opportunity, we don't actually live up to that faith at all. We see that equality of opportunity distorted in all kinds of ways. And so when we get to the back end of it, right, which is whether you are, you know, you're being rewarded for your drive, effort, and brains, and I'm being punished for my slothfulness, right?
Pardon the example, but you know what I'm doing here.
Those inputs are just not as clear as we would like them to be, right? We can't make those assessments. Some kid who worked really hard in East Harlem in his elementary school, very bright kid, didn't have access to a tutor, and doesn't make the cut at Hunter. What are we saying to that kid?
So
right?
Are you saying that, and I totally see what you're saying here.
Yeah.
I mean, if my mother's a drug addict and my dad is long gone, you know, and I can't afford $90 an hour for a tutor, I'm not going to get any, even if I'm the smartest person, you know, in town. But are you saying that our whole society is like that, you know, rigged from start to finish? We really don't have equality of opportunity.
More than we want to admit, yes. I mean, that is what I'm saying. It is far more rigged than we want to. And I think it's borne out by declining levels of social mobility and rising levels of inequality. I mean, I think if it weren't rigged, right, we would see a lot more fluidity. I mean, what we would imagine would be a lot of the children of the very powerful and very rich, ending up working blue collar jobs, right? And because some of them aren't that bright or that hardworking, but we never see that, do we? We never see that. And we would see a lot more people from the bottom fifth of the income distribution, running major corporations. And we don't see a ton of that. We see way less of it than we think. We sort of pluck out the examples of the kid from the farm in Kansas who ends up in Harvard Law, or the kid from the South Bronx who ends up at Goldman Sachs. But those are really the exceptions.
Well, let's get our listeners back into this. Chris, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org, or you can go to our Facebook page, join the conversation there. And let's go to Manchester next. John is on the air. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Sure. Go ahead, John.
Good. I think there's so many different issues that could contribute to this bureaucracy failure just because of there's so much of it. And I realize there are some good things that have come. We seem to be safer, but yet we've still been, Anyway, I think the main point is that I think the banks are at the root of it. And if you go back into history, there's a great CD, it's Capital Crimes, Case Against the Federal Reserve and the International Banks. And I think that they are, along with the IRS, which nobody has any lost love for them, is that they're creating debt around the world, I mean, from our standpoint in this country, creating and putting people into huge amounts of debt whereby this is, you know, spiraling this whole problem. And with all the other things that have happened.
Hey, John, can I ask you a quick question? Because we're talking tomorrow about savings and spending, our latest habits since the recession began. You say banks are creating debt. You don't have to take out those loans, John. You can say no to the loan or no to the credit card.
No, I'm not. Well, I understand that. I don't mean just the loans.
Uh-huh.
I mean the Federal Reserve that have the collection agency, which is the IRS. I mean, I work until May before my debt is paid to the IRS, which has nothing to do with our government. It's money changers of the world. It's the Federal Reserve banks that are not U.S.-based.
So high taxes, John? Is that the problem?
Well,
high taxes?
If you look at when Kennedy and Lincoln both attempted to put in U.S.-backed dollars and eliminate or get away from the Federal Reserve noose, and it obviously didn't work.
Yeah, okay. Well, John, thanks for calling. Lots of concepts there. I wonder what you think, Chris Hayes, if you could pick up on one or two of those points.
Let me take a step back and say that John's distrust of the Federal Reserve has a long tradition in American history, and the Federal Reserve is an institution that is central, that is both central to our economic and political life, and also shrouded in secrecy. And a lot of the distrust directed towards the Federal Reserve has been deserved by the Federal Reserve because it has not conducted itself in a particularly transparent or democratic manner. And in fact, you know, the first meeting to think of coming up with a central bank was done in secret. And there's been a shroud of secrecy over the institution. And people feel a frustration, distrust for it because they feel that it is not subject to democratic accountability and that it fundamentally is doing things without their say-so and in the dark and things often that we can't even process or understand. And so it is a perfect kind of symbol of people's distrust towards powerful institutions that do seem unaccountable. I also think the Federal Reserve is very responsible for not more forthrightly attacking the problems in the subprime sector when they were brought to its attention. And the Federal Reserve has a lot of power as a regulator. It could have done a lot during that time to go after these very dangerous loan practices, and it did not. It looked the other way, and it helped produce the crisis. I think the specific critique of the Federal Reserve in terms of fractional reserve banking and the IRS that John is leveraging is something that I don't agree with, and it is coming from a kind of different political perspective than my own in the way that I think about the Federal Reserve. But I do think that the people distrust the Federal Reserve and have distrust towards the institution because they suspect that it is loosed itself from the basics of democratic accountability. And I think that is a totally fair critique.
We did see a large distrust of the Federal Reserve in the presidential campaign of Ron Paul. Applause line for him.
Sure. And not just Ron Paul. I mean, remember Rick Perry said, you know, if Ben Bernanke keeps printing money, I don't know what you do here in Iowa, but we treat him pretty rough down in Texas. I mean, it has actually become distrust of the Federal Reserve and fears of inflation and the whole sort of overlapping set of concepts and critiques have become a core part of the Republican catechism.
Okay, and I want to go back to our listeners. Lots of people want to jump in, but before I do, John also mentioned taxes, and I'm glad he did. Thanks, John, for the call. You in this book, Chris, call for higher taxes to reduce income equality. You cite examples of how this is done in Europe, but we are not Europe. We have never been Europe. We will never be Europe. So why go there, Chris? Why even bother with this sort of, you know, tired solution that's been offered up a million times by liberal America?
That's a very funny way of putting it. I mean, first of all, I talk as much in the book about Latin America as I do in Europe, right? Latin America,
Brazil, especially.
Yeah, Brazil particularly, right? But what's happened in Brazil has happened in all parts of Latin America. Latin America has bucked the trend of inequality that has taken root elsewhere in the world. The U.S. is probably the most unequal place, along with Great Britain, but all countries we're seeing more or less in the industrialized world particularly are getting more unequal. Latin America has bucked that trend, particularly Brazil, under the stewardship of Ignacio Lula. And the way that it's done it and the reason that I elevate it is that if we want a society that's more equal, I mean, one of the arguments I'm making in the book is the kind of inequality we have produces crisis. The more elitist society gets, the worst caliber of elites it produces is. And a society with a huge social distance between those at the top and those at the bottom is destined to produce crisis, catastrophe, incompetence, and corruption, like we have seen, okay? If we want to avoid that, and this is not an argument from the perspective of justice, right? I'm not making an argument that it would be more just or moral to have a more equal society. I'm saying it would be more stable. It would be better for all of us. We would avoid catastrophe. If we want a more equal society, and we've had a more equal society in terms of income inequality, even in our past, you don't have to look to Europe, right? This period between 1930 and 1975, more or less, tremendous gains to middle-class wages, a reduction in inequality. The way to get that isn't rocket science. I mean, other countries have figured out how to do it. If you raise the minimum wage, if you create universal public benefits that people pay for with taxes, such as universal health care and universal pension systems, universal higher education, if you have a more redistributive tax system, even if these sound like, tired cliche parts of the liberal catechism, they're tired cliche parts of the liberal catechism because when put into practice, they have the intended effect, which is that they make society more equal. And a more equal society, my argument in the book is, will be a more stable one. It will be better off for everyone else, including the elites themselves, because eventually we're not – the crisis – the period of crisis is not done unless we see some significant reformation, unless the society does grow more equal, unless we shrink the social distance between those at the top and those at the bottom. The crises that we have seen over this decade are going to continue into the future, and I really want to avoid that because I think the next one, whatever it is, could be even worse than what we've faced so far.
So higher taxes, you're arguing, more income equality, or at least not as big a disparity as you see now. That is the way to reduce this social distance, which allows elites to be so elite and not listen to anybody else outside of their own circle and mess up in a big way.
Yeah, I mean, I think
that's the bottom line.
It's one small part of it, right? I mean, there's a whole bunch of different ways we can make more equality. I think that if we expanded the role of public universal benefits, right? If we were all going to, I mean, right? One easy thing we're doing right now is we're eviscerating state colleges. Right, they're being destroyed by state budget cuts. Right, these have been tremendous engines of social mobility for years, very proud systems because they could be afforded by the working class and poor and middle class, but also were of such a high quality that people with a lot of money would send their kids there. Places like Madison, Wisconsin, University of Michigan, Berkeley, etc. These are all we're seeing tuition hikes. We're seeing an institution that has operated very, has done a lot for social mobility. Being more stratified. So, that's one place where it's a very sort of low-hanging fruit, right, to create a system in which people – what we need are we need systems, and state college is a great example, where people from across these different strata of American society are engaged together as equals. And we increasingly have fewer and fewer of those over time. And the last thing I'll say is we also need – and this is something where there's a certain – degree to which a lone author isn't going to be the genesis for this kind of thinking, but we need institutional experimentation and innovation. I mean, I mentioned this in the book. I mean, some of the most creative responses to the crisis of authority, Wikipedia, for example, Move On, things that have happened on the internet, come from organic experimentation and new institutional forms. And we've seen during other periods of social reformation in this country, things like farmers' cooperatives, right, social clubs in the cities that started among working immigrants that created new kinds of relationships between people and were the foundation of new institutions. We need those sorts of institutional experimentation right now.
Well, here's an email that I'd like to close out with, and this is from Brett. He says, please discuss attempting to cater to constituents' unrealistic expectation as a cause of failures in the decision-making by both corporate and government bodies. By this, Brett says, I mean shareholders and voters, respectively. What about that, Chris? You know, it's not enough for us to sit here and whine.
Yeah, I think this is an argument. David Brooks actually makes exactly this argument in the New York Times today, as it so happens. You know, the idea that the leaders don't get the credit they should, and that we the collective us are partly to blame. There's a certain degree to which, as citizens, we always have responsibility for what's happening to our country. And I think one of the things that happens, and it's a process I describe at one point in the book, is that, democracy is not a stable equilibrium. You look over time, right? There's been lots of attempts at democracy. And because we live in a democracy, we live in probably the most admired democracy in the world in certain ways, and certainly we admire it the most here in the U.S., we take it as a given. We take it as a given that we're going to have self-governance. But when you think about what self-governance actually means, it's an incredibly radical proposition. I mean, when you sit on the subway or you sit – in some public space, you think we're all figuring out what we're all going to do. That's a radical proposition, and it's not a stable one. We have to be active as citizens. We start to get lazy. We start to outsource it. But there's no excuse for sitting back. I mean, one of the things that's required by democracy is an active citizenry. And I think that there's a case we made that we have gotten more and more lax, and we can't afford that anymore.
Well, Chris, we have to close it out. And Brett, I want to thank you for that last email. Chris, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Chris Hayes, editor-at-large of The Nation, host of Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. His new book is called The Twilight of the Elites. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Craig Martin. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange is now on Facebook. Become a fan of our Facebook page where you can learn more about upcoming shows and get extra links and material. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, the savings dilemma. When the recession began, Americans started pinching their pennies and repaying debt, causing some to speculate that consumers might permanently abandon their free spending ways. But now Americans are loosening their purse strings. We'll look at how and why our savings habits change and how these variations affect the larger economy. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange. Tomorrow morning, live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.